Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Network Rail Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Amazon Prime Video UK. The home of, well, what was the US Open and what was the Laver Cup in the UK. It is not the Network Rail Podcast. Sorry, David, that I've just lost at least half of our listeners. Get back into podcast mode, Catherine. We are, though, at Waterloo Station, yeah. And I felt like I should introduce people early on to the fact that there are going to be sound effects, non-tennis related sound effects to this podcast, one of which is the sound of a gaggle of pigeons absolutely savaging a leftover pastry. David is taking a selfie of himself. He looks genuinely concerned. I mean, they are laying into this. Goodness me. Okay. So sounds that you will during this podcast include train announcements, coffee being ground, pigeons eating things.
Yes.
Yeah, is that about it?
That pretty much covers it.
And you'll also hear the sound of us talking about tennis.
Yeah, we'll do that too.
I'm Catherine Whittaker. This is David Law. This is the Tennis Podcast, to be clear. The Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. Simon Briggs of The Telegraph has been at the Laver Cup in Chicago this week. And don't worry, we will be talking about that in due course on this week's podcast. What would you like to start with first, though, David?
Second week in a row, I want to start with Naomi Osaka, who reached the final in Tokyo, and I thought was just so impressive to back up what she'd done at the US Open with all the rigmarole that had gone with it, and then she still manages to come out and she went straight sets all the way to the final. Eventually ran into Karolina Pliskova, who served more than 80% first serves in.
Almost unplayable, that,
to win
isn't
the
it?
Title. 6-4, 6-4. Nice to see Pliskova playing well again, because she's looked miserable. And actually,
don't hold back, David.
I really enjoyed an interview that the WTA did with her, in which she said, the key for me is, she recently ditched half her coaching team, and her dad was with her. She's being helped by Renee Stubbs now as well, isn't she?
And what, Conchita Martinez, is that continued?
No, that was just a Wimbledon. But
US Open.
But what she said, Pliskova, was, I need a really positive team around me because I'm negative. And a negative person like me can't have a negative team around.
Well, that's why I record a podcast with you, David.
I very much understand
that.
Yeah. So, yeah, somebody who's up for it and chatting away to pigeons in Waterloo. I just found that really an interesting insight into her psyche. I like her honesty. She doesn't. If you ask Karolina Pliskova a straight question, she gives you a straight answer. But Osaka, she came out and she thrashed Dominika Sibulkova in her first match in Tokyo, bear in mind. You know, imagine all the eyes on her. And I immediately said, look, often you see players have a slump. We remember Sloane Stephens last year having her 8-match losing streak. We've seen Garbiñe Muguruza struggle with that kind of thing in the past. Some people pointed out it's one match. What are you getting fussed about one match for? 10 out of the 14 current or first-time Grand Slam holders won their next match, apparently, I was told. But she went on, reached the final. Okay, she lost to Karolina Pliskova, but I like the fact that she did what she did,
and she continued her ruthlessness from the U.S. Open. That's what was different for me about Naomi Osaka at the U.S. Open. Her utter ruthlessness and dominating of players, yeah. No wobbles, just complete conviction in herself. And as you say, she didn't drop a set en route to the final. She just, whatever zone she was in, she was still in it. And I think that even withstanding the defeat to Pliskova in the final, because 80% of first serves from Pliskova, I'm not sure what anybody does about that, really.
Not much.
Osaka played really well in the final.
Blueprint for Pliskova now to go onwards, although Osaka has subsequently pulled straight out of Wuhan.
Yeah, with a viral illness. I mean, she may have a viral illness, I don't know, but does it do anyone any... I think it's absolutely fine for her to pull out of Wuhan. A shame for Wuhan, which is a tournament that I think I said this previously on the podcast, that I always have a bit of a sort of sentimental soft spot for, and I always wish them well, and I really suffer their player withdrawals with them, because the tournament was set up for Li Na. Wuhan, yes, is Li Na's hometown. I mean, they're pretty open about the fact that it was, you know, she became Grand Slam champion and they decided, let's bring a tournament to her hometown. And I think she retired 2 weeks before the inaugural event.
Oh, that hurts.
Yeah, and look, she still supports it. She turns up there every year. She is very supportive of it. But look, it's a blow that still lingers for that tournament. I was sad for them that Osaka withdrew, as much as I find it very understandable. Had it not been her home tournament in Tokyo, I wouldn't have perhaps been that surprised if she'd taken a bit more time after the US Open and not played there. But, it's been a bit of a theme on the podcast this year, hasn't it, about just how relentless the calendar is. You've got no time to appreciate your victories. Simona Halep said that at Wimbledon, didn't she? It just came too quickly. I had no time to enjoy the French
Open. And actually, I got into a chat with Sven Grunewald, former coach of Maria Sharapova, about this, and he was lamenting the fact that people like me in the media, and he wasn't having a go, but he was lamenting the fact that we always talk about big name players having suffered defeats as opposed to the players that have beaten them, and the fact that we don't talk as much about the good aspects of multiple Grand Slam champions as opposed to players that have won multiple Grand Slam titles. And I defended it, because a story is a story, and a story is based on the person you're talking about and what they've done and all the rest of it. And I did say, though, but do you think that Osaka and Zverev, for instance, are going to do what Serena Williams and Roger Federer have done? And he said, no, I don't, but because of the schedule. And he was quite specific. I mean, who knows whether they're actually as good as those players anyway. But he felt that with this current schedule, and obviously these players have to play a certain amount of tournaments in order to count towards rankings, or you get fines and all the rest of it. The tours are trying to support their main events, which I understand, but they do it by trying to oblige players to play a lot. That's the problem.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Oh, goodness me, a pigeon has just swooped within about an inch of David's head.
I actually felt that.
This is hazardous. Yeah. Help us to pigeon-proof this station is a sign that is on our table. I don't think that's a battle they're winning.
No. This is where it's not good being 6 foot seven, because I do look like a statue that one could land on.
Yeah, even sat down, David is taller than most people stood up. Staying in the Far East, David, we have had Andy Murray announcing, he's not played in the Far East yet, but he will be playing in Shenzhen this week. He has announced that he'll be shutting down his season after Beijing. So he'll play Shenzhen and Beijing, and then he will end his season in order to, quote, focus on some intense reconditioning and training blocks in the next couple of months, with a view to being in the best possible shape for Australia in January. Everyone seems to be pretty united in this being a wise decision. I mean, he's not going to be seeded for any of these events, so if he did slog his way through more events in the Far East and then went to Paris and maybe Basel or Vienna or something like that, there's every chance he'd be drawing Federer in round one and losing, and, you know, okay, that's only one match, but we know that what goes into going to an event and getting yourself ready for it is a lot more than one match. So to take himself out of that equation and do what he calls reconditioning,
yeah,
seems like maybe a good idea.
Yeah, a few people did say to me, well, wouldn't it be better to just try to build up that match toughness and all the rest of it? I mean, judgment call, isn't it, really? My instinct is it's the right thing to do. I think that's partly built on a conversation I remember having with Nigel Sears, his father-in-law, back in May, I think, or maybe even earlier than that. I think maybe even March, when Andy was really suffering with the injury and obviously not able to play at that time. And he said that he did feel that there's a strong argument for just shutting down this year completely and saying, let's try and come out for 2019 firing. You know, this was just in conversation. And at that point, if somebody had said to me that Andy Murray would have come back, played Queens, played the US Open, won those matches in Washington, blimey, I'd have said, that's a good set of results from where he is. So I feel that this is probably the right decision, best of both worlds. He's had some matches. He's got an idea of where he is and what he still needs to do, other setbacks not permitting. And, let's see if he can put in a proper training block. He's, what, got 3 months? Three months' worth of time.
And in reading too much into Andy Murray's statement news, I find it interesting and heartening that he uses the word reconditioning in his statement rather than rehabilitation. Yeah. It's about conditioning and getting himself fit enough. I could be reading between lines where there is nothing, but if he had said rehabilitation still, I get the impression the hip is as good as it's going to be. We still don't know how good that is relative to, you know, peak Andy Murray hip, but it's all about, you know, match fitness now.
He looked
rather
very
than getting
upbeat
the hip better.
In his Facebook video, he looked up for it. He looked excited, really, about the process to come. So, well, good luck to him.
David, you're at risk of missing the 14:05 to Windsor and Eton Riverside. Oh. That is what the latest announcement has told us.
I needed that one.
The 14:15 to Hazelmere, though, is still possible.
Okay, I've got Basingstoke on my...
Portsmouth Harbour, what do you fancy? Guildford? No. Hounslow? I don't recommend Hounslow.
Let's just do the podcast.
Mohamed Layani, David.
Yes.
Suspended by the ATP because, quote, he compromised his own impartiality as a chair umpire during the US Open incident with Nick Kyrgios, as he'll miss Beijing and Shanghai. And I think this is pretty much the sort of action sanction that you were calling for at the time of the incident, I'm fine with this as a sanction. As I said at the time, I still have question marks over whether there will be any lingering impact in the minds of the players. I hope there won't be. I hope that this can be the end of it and confidence can be restored. But I certainly think it's the right thing for them to implement some kind of sanction.
It's the right tone to it in that they've made it clear that they've taken it seriously. The ATP have gone beyond what the USTA did and have said, look, our view on our official is that he didn't do his job right in this instance, and we are going to punish that fact. Two tournament suspension, no pay, which does feel harsh, but I also get the point of doing it. It's a clear message sent out, not only to Mohamed Layani, but to all officials. This is the standard we expect. It also tells players, we're watching this stuff closely. Mohamed Layani is not going to get in trouble like this again, I don't think, because he's a good umpire, first and foremost. This is a bit of a reality check for everybody, though, of just where the line is a little. And incidentally, we should just go forward, I think, and just link this to the Serena Williams situation. Ooh. Once more, because she has been in an interview with Lisa Wilkinson of Channel 10 in Australia. She was doing the interview to promote breast cancer awareness, but clearly she wanted to ask about the US Open incident as part of this interview, and it was interrupted by a publicist after three questions of this interview. And the interesting thing to me is not the interruption, which you know, that sort of stuff happens. It was more the quotes from Serena Williams about Patrick Mouratoglou's coaching. She was asked, Serena, in the interview, your coach admitted that he was coaching from the sidelines. In retrospect, do you think that that makes the violation warranted? And Serena said, I just don't understand what he was talking about, meaning Mouratoglou, because we don't have signals. We've never had signals. And he said he made a motion. She was then asked, so you had to have a fairly tough conversation with him afterwards? And Serena said, yes, because we've never had this before. I was like, it's okay, but don't, like, you know. So she's not happy with Patrick Mouratoglou for the signals, and she's not happy with him for admitting that he did it either.
The nuances of their relationship are amazing. Like I can't even begin to fathom them, really. But this is nothing new, her being unhappy with Patrick. I mean, she said it in that interview. Was it with Vogue? Or I think it was with another glossy magazine pre-US Open, where she said how unhappy she was with him advising her to stop breastfeeding. She said that was... didn't enjoy taking that from a bloke, you know. She's quite happy to express her displeasure with Patrick's behaviour in
public.
Maybe
that's why it works. You know, he basically says whatever he wants whenever he feels like it. And then she slags him
exactly
off.
Exactly. And, you know, he was, the day after the whole incident, he was commentating for Eurosport on the men's final. You know, he was taking selfies. He was absolutely fine. We were all worried that he was going to get the sack and, oh, to be a fly on the wall during their post-match debrief. I reckon she probably said, Patrick, you... Pratt. He said, all right, I won't do that again, and on they moved.
Yeah, well,
it's
fascinating. I like how candid he is in many ways.
For me, just before we move on, that wasn't necessarily the most interesting thing about that. You breezed past the interruption of the publicist. Now, yeah, we know that happens all the time, but yeah. I do think it's important and interesting that they published that and they made that public, because I think it's important to know. I think it's important for the public to know that the constraints that are so very often put on the access that we get to top players, you know, as journalists and broadcasters, you know, often it's a reflection on us that we don't ask the hard-hitting questions, or that we don't go down a particular avenue, but just to be given, you know, a fleeting moment of these big players' names, celebrities' time, you often have to consent to so many restrictions on that time,
and look,
that you're unable to. And yet, all the public sees is the end product.
Catherine, I'm the media director at Queen's. I have granted many an interview with people on the understanding that they mention the fact that this player is going to play the Fevertree Championships at the Queen's Club. That's become how it works, right? Now, aside from that, that's as far as I go. I never say, and you can't talk about X, Y, and Z, because I hate that sort of thing as a journalist myself. And I also think, I don't think that really does anybody any favours. I think I'd much rather a player handles that situation themselves. And if they don't want to talk about something, they either don't, or they sketch around it, or they just point blank say, don't want to talk about that.
Well, that's the other thing. She looked over at her publicist. She sought the intervention. And the question that she was asked at the point at which she sought the intervention was, do you regret your behaviour in the moment on the court? And there was a long pause, and she very definitely looked over and said, can you, you know, her eyes were saying, can you save me from this, please? And I found it very disappointing, because regardless of the point she was making about women and everything, and I think we've covered our feelings on that and the array of views, I think we can all agree she behaved really badly. Even if you think she had a really strong point and she was in the right, she still dealt with it appallingly. She still behaved badly on the court. And I think she can not diminish her point. In fact, she can probably strengthen the point if she still wishes to persist with that point, by just saying, look, I didn't deal with it very well. I was in the heat of the moment. I shouldn't have behaved like that. There are certain actions I wish I could take back, but hey, I'm a full-blooded competitor and I'm not always fully in control of my actions in the moment. But for her to just sort of back out of even giving a fudged answer to the question by seeking intervention, I found disappointing.
Yeah.
And also her answer to the Patrick thing sort of willfully missed the point. You don't have to have agreed signal. I mean, I could interpret what Patrick was saying. You don't have to have an agreed system of signals for, you know, and it doesn't matter if you've agreed something in advance. Your coach's behaviour is a reflection on you, and she's definitely been made aware of that rule before now.
Look,
that's a deflection.
If that is her view, though, generally, what she's basically saying is he blew it. And fair enough, you know. I mean, it also points to the kind of desperation of the moment and how badly she was getting beaten.
Exactly. Look, I can understand that. I can understand people behaving in a regrettable way, which they then hold their hands up to and regret. I just wish she had done that, because there was a really big opportunity for her to do it, and she didn't. It's a shame.
Yeah.
But hey, breast cancer awareness, great.
At least that is good to promote, obviously. So well done to her for that.
Absolutely. Staying in the Far East, David, I know you moved us on to Australia briefly there.
Yeah, I did.
I'm running this. I'm driving this train, David.
You've got an agenda. Catherine's going off-piste.
I've decided to take it geographically.
Go for it.
Remaining in the Far East, Kiki Bertens has won a third title of the season in Seoul. She defeated Ayla Tomljanovic in the final. Quite a big result for Tomljanovic, that.
Yeah.
She's had a tough old time. Qiang Wang in Guangzhou defeated Yulia Putintseva.
Well, there's another one. Wang is another one who's quietly built a really good year. I think she's in the top 40 in the world now.
Coached by Peter McNamara.
Yes.
I always say that because that's my... I will work on this, but I don't have that many Qiang Wang facts, and that is my main one.
Yeah, same here. And we know Peter a little bit.
And now we're moving geographically westwards now, David. Just to
take me where we're going. I'm not very good with directions.
Shall we head to Russia?
Go for it. What's going on in Russia?
Mikhail Yuzhny has retired in St. Petersburg.
He has.
He's retired, David, on 499 match wins.
I mean, that
can't bear it.
That is a comeback that has to happen.
He must really have wanted to retire. He must really have had enough. Do you know what I mean?
Wouldn't you, you could basically go the full 12 months of the calendar next year and just keep watching the tournaments, right, and look at the entry lists. And then when you see the right one and the right surface, and you just put your hand up and ask for a quick wild card and say, look, all I want to try
to do, you will do that?
Get to 500 wins.
Basically wanted to retire at home in Russia. Great, you know, I'm glad he got to do that. He deserved, you know, a great send-off. He lost in the second round to Bautista Agut. So he got himself up to, he was on 498 before last week. You know, it's right that he should retire with, you know, the appropriate send-off, which of course he'd get in Russia. But come on, Mikhail.
But what if he won two and he ended up with 501? That's really unsatisfactory.
Fine. No, I think that's fine.
It's jarring.
Yeah, I'd sleep easier at night on 501. I just don't know how he's ever going to sleep again.
Right. Oh, well, can we pay tribute to Mikhail Yuzhny?
When
did you first hear of Mikhail Yuzhny?
Oh my gosh. I mean, he's been a thing for as long as I've been into tennis.
Do you know, I think one of the first times I ever remember hearing of him was in 2001. He came to Queens and he beat a similarly young Andy Roddick in the first round. And you know how in tennis and in sport generally, you try to latch onto something with every player. He's going to be the new so-and-so or whatever. Reminds me of so-and-so, or reminds me of his backhands like Federer's or whatever it might be. Well, with Mikhail Yuzhny back then, it was, doesn't he look like Michael Owen? Everybody, and of course, Michael Owen was big news back then because he was England's main striker, and he just scored the goals that had won the UEFA Cup, and it was called the UEFA Cup back then, for Liverpool. And everybody was saying,
Kalavez in the final.
The Russian tennis player that looks like Michael Owen is how everybody was trying to bill it. And when you actually then put them side by side, they kind of look nothing like each other.
They've got the same fuzzy hair.
Yeah. And then over the years, obviously, Mikhail Yuzhny managed to get himself 499 match wins, two US Open semi-finals, 10 ATP titles, 31 wins against top 10 opponents, and finished inside the top 50 13 consecutive years. And he also smashed himself over the head with
the
a racket.
Most impressive self-flagellation ever on a tennis court.
How many views has that had, I wonder? We need to find that out.
And he got himself a philosophy degree along the way.
That's pretty good going.
Might even have been a master's, actually. Certainly a degree. So well done, Mikhail Yuzhny.
Yeah. Great career.
Staying in St. Petersburg, Dominic Thiem won the title. defeated Kljan. It's his first hard court title since February 2016. Signs, David. Obviously, the biggest sign was what he did at the US Open, but backing that up on the hard courts, thank goodness.
Well, I mean, I'd love to know why he didn't. I assume he could have been picked for Laver Cup, and he's obviously opted for St. Petersburg, which is interesting. We'll go on to Laver Cup.
There's a few that could probably apply to, and I'd love to know if offers were made and were refused. We'll never know, but we can but speculate. Anything else happened in Russia this week, David, before I move on to France?
No, I don't know any more about Russia.
So moving on to Metz, Gilles Simon defeated Matthias Backinger.
Yes, he did. Well
Metz
done, Gilles.
One of those... It's just a bitty time of year, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
I'm pleased for Gilles Simon there because, not a lot's happened with his career the last year or two.
Well, speaking of that, there was a challenger happening in somewhere in China where Gasquet and Monfils were playing one another. And Monfils ended up winning the challenger, I think.
Uh-huh.
Winning the whole shebang. I think they played...
Oh, no, it's Gulbis.
Oh, Gulbis and
Gulbis
Monfils.
And Monfils.
Yeah, Gulbis and Monfils in a challenger in China with about four people watching.
And they both Grand Slam semi-finalists.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a good ticket to have.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Right then, David, I've covered the bitty bits.
Yes.
Should we do Laver Cup?
Let's do Laver Cup. First of all, it was won by Team Europe, 13 points to 8, and they didn't end up playing the final match, although it was very close all the way through, and probably I think a lot of people would say closer than they would have expected it, given when you looked at the lineups on paper of Team Europe with Federer, Djokovic, Zverev, who else did they have? Goffin.
They're Jeremy Shardy, David.
Jeremy Shardy, who was the alternate, didn't get a look in. But did some good...
Just pleased to be there.
Bench support.
Pleased to get himself a free jacket.
Up against Nick Kyrgios, John Isner, Francis Tiafoe.
Nicholas Jarry, also pleased to get a free jacket.
Jack Sock, Captain John McEnroe. Jack Sock winning three doubles matches. I mean, what a doubles player that guy is, first of all. That was the score. Europe winning it for the second year in a row. Incredible turnout of people in Chicago. 93,000 people over 3 days. So you're talking 16,000 on a Friday afternoon. Like the O2, double sessions each day. 18,000 and 19,000 each session over the weekend, which is an incredible turnout. Slickest production you could imagine. I mean, it was like watching the Oscars in terms of its slickness.
That is not the analogy you used with me on WhatsApp, David. Come on.
What did I use?
Miss World.
Yes, there was that one bit.
Made me laugh out loud, David. It deserved an airing.
Well, only
tennis is Miss World.
Only because it was just everything's great, you know, as yeah. as these things tend to be. It was glossy.
Yeah.
It was glossy. But I mean, also it was immaculately produced. There's no question, and that's including the TV coverage and the sort of, I thought, the thinking about it, the way that they staged it. Generally, I thought it was it was good that they didn't have one of what was clearly that set piece conversation behind the scenes with Federer, Borg, and Nadal that they had last year, which was excruciating, really. I get why they did it, but it was excruciating. They didn't do any of that. It was much more. And what was quite interesting was watching it. I watched it on Amazon Prime, where you don't have the adverts. You could have watched it on Sky in the UK, where you do. I saw it on Prime, and therefore you got to hear these conversations at the sit-downs. The most interesting bits of the lot, of the whole tie, were hearing Federer talking to Zverev about tactics and things like that, and really going deep into them. And just seeing those interactions, which we've never seen before. We've never heard those sort of conversations before. Found it fascinating. Some of the matches, some of the tennis was really spellbinding, and there were a couple of matches I saw, doubles with Zverev and Federer against Isner and Sock, and there was also the Zverev against Isner singles match that I saw. A couple of the matches were overnight our time, and I didn't get to see them, but they were, I mean, I was really on the edge of my seat for a couple of those.
Were you on the edge of your seat because you were really supporting Team Europe?
No,
and really into it from
all.
A partisan kind
not
of upright.
At all.
Okay.
And you know, look, I've said all the things, and there are many that I think that there are commendable about this and exciting about this operation. Richard Evans, a colleague of ours, said he felt it was the best standing start production of a new event that he can remember, and I would actually agree with that in many ways. Maybe the O2 is certainly another one. But that has got the history of a year-end event behind it for many years. I do think, considering that they've started this out of absolutely nothing, it is amazing what they've done. But there are some problems with it from my standpoint for its future. And I suppose what I'm getting at is, Where does it want to be in the calendar? Where does it want to be in the pecking order? What does it see itself as? Because it was trying to bill itself as, and we were being told it was the Ryder Cup of tennis. We discussed this, of course, a year ago. Now, the Ryder Cup is about to take place in a few days' time when we talk about it. Mass media coverage, everybody interested in it. That's not the Laver Cup right now. You know, our colleague Simon Briggs went over to interview Roger Federer for the Telegraph ahead of the event. He didn't stay for the actual tennis. He didn't cover the matches one at a time. He did a piece about it and about where it stands, and spoke to people like Federer about the Davis Cup and all those sort of things. But as an event and who wins, etc., it hasn't got huge amounts of coverage, because there is still this debate about, well, is it an exhibition? Is it a serious event? What is it? Now, no question, in my mind at least, that it was incredibly competitively fought. It was exciting. The players were all into it. And it was fun to see their interaction and to see them that invested in a team competition like this. But if you're telling me that is the Ryder Cup of the sport, well, it's not. It might be one day, maybe in 20 years' time, maybe in 10 years' time, I don't know. Maybe everybody will care about the results, and I don't just mean the players. I get that the players can invest themselves in a red jersey. I'm playing for reds, you're playing for blues, and we want to beat them. I get all that, because in the moment, it is exciting, and you feel that. We saw it with Nadal and Federer last year, but I don't think anybody leaves that arena thinking, oh, thank goodness Europe won, or thank goodness World won, or I desperately want World to win it next year. I don't know how you build that, but it doesn't have that impact on me.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there's so much to get your teeth into there. I mean, I share all your thoughts. My conclusion on it was, I don't love it. I'm not in love with it, an event, but I don't think it's for me. Speaking to a few colleagues from the tennis world who work to varying degrees in the tennis world about it, Sarah Woolland, in fact, a colleague of ours, who quite often has a slightly different perspective. She sort of dips in and out of tennis and worked on the Champions Tour with us, so, you know, has a good deal of experience of exhibition tennis, and we'll come on to the definition of exhibition tennis in a minute, because there's a lot of chat around the fact that the exhibition seems to become a dirty word when I don't think it should. But I think we perhaps need to restore the reputation of the word exhibition. But she said, look, it's not for the nerdy tennis fan, or, you know, the people that work in tennis week in, week out. It's for the really casual tennis fan. It's for the people that just watch Wimbledon in the UK, that stumble upon it on Sky and think, oh, what's this, you know, glossy, eye-catching thing that the crowd seem to be desperately into. And I get that, you know. She said, imagine that you're somebody that watches tennis a week or two a year, and you stumble across that on your telly or on Amazon Prime. You'd probably stick with it for at least a few minutes, and maybe those few minutes would be enough to grab you and make you think, hey, tennis is a great thing. Certainly everybody in the United Center in Chicago seemed to be absolutely loving it. And I don't want to be sniffy about 94,000 people over a weekend in the stadium, and goodness knows how many on the TV loving tennis. And I suspect a lot of those were people who previously were varying degrees of indifferent about tennis. I'm fine with that. I think there's a place for it in the tennis world, and I support that place. I personally didn't... I thought a lot of the tennis was high quality, and I was trying to focus on just enjoying the tennis, but a lot of the other elements of it distracted from that enough to take my enjoyment away. I found it overproduced and overslick, and, you know, like they were trying to ram the meaning of it down my throat. And maybe it's sort of the cynical British contrarian in me that instantly, when someone's trying to impose something upon me, I instantly sort of back off from it and go, oh, hang on a minute. You know, I found the constant cutaways, like after every point, to the team celebrating, you know, Jack Sock thumping his chest after a run-of-the-mill Kevin Anderson ace. I found that tough to take. I agree with you. Not all of that I didn't. I loved hearing Roger Federer doing coaching. I loved that. The other players doing coaching, you know, they seem to talk largely in slogans and sort of, enjoyed, you know, come on, man. But Federer doing coaching, fascinating.
Well, and Kyle Edmund coaching Roger Federer was also
yeah.
a highlight.
Kyle Edmund, incidentally, absolute revelation. I don't know what's happened to him, or he seems to have been possessed by some sort of other being. Because Mike, I've interviewed Kyle Edmund a lot, and that was a different guy.
He's been Labour cupped.
That was a different guy. And, you know, the sort of transformation that took place in Kyle Edmund over the course of that weekend, if that sort of the nugget of that stays in him somewhere, think little things like that could be the making of the Labour Cup. The fact that it can have a transformative effect on a player, you know, what it did to Jack Sock at the end of last year, okay, is that doesn't seem to have lasted in any way in his singles form, which detracts from it slightly, but those sorts of things give it legitimacy, I think, or could give it legitimacy over the long term. So as much as I found it hilarious seeing Kyle Edmund beating his chest and all of that.
I particularly liked it when he stomped into the dressing room after Federer's won and basically body-checked about four people.
Some sort of incredible Hulk. I thought he'd been bitten by a spider, Spider-Man style. It was amazing. So look, I'm reluctant to be too cynical about it, because I don't think it's for me. I don't think it's for the nerdy, cynical British tennis fan. I'm supportive of it without particularly personally enjoying it, if that makes sense. I don't also want to question how much of my lack of enjoyment of it, not lack of, I mean, I watched quite a lot of it, was from the fact that we were watching a world feed of it, and there's no doubt it's very obviously, and they have every right to do this, it's very obviously a corporate product, isn't it, the World Feed? No one's ever going to say anything bad about the Labour Cup on that production that we're watching. And I saw on Twitter that Tennis Channel had their own studio and their own team out there. They were covering it independently. And I actually tried to seek out a Tennis Channel, an illegal Tennis Channel stream in the UK, to see if watching a more independent production of it made me feel differently about it, because I was so aware that I was watching a slick corporate product. I found that quite difficult. And again, that
as
might
good
be
as it was.
As good and as slick as,
and I think they're all brilliant.
Elements
broadcasts.
Of it are, you know, look, the camera angles are sensational. Undoubtedly, you know, there was a shot from sort of seemed like there was a camera on the roof when Djokovic, I think, lobbed Kevin Anderson, and there was a shot of it from there. And I just thought that was brilliant. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yes, I could do with a lot fewer shots of Jack Sock thumping his chest, but equally there were lots of things that I loved about the production. But I was very aware that I was watching a corporate product, and I don't necessarily enjoy that hugely, as good as the corporate product is. So yeah, that's not something that's necessarily fixed in stone. Maybe
what about the scoring system? Because one of the appeals and yet issues with the event and the format for me is the fact that it's weighted with 1 point for a match win on a Friday, 2 points for a match win on Saturday, and 3 points for a match win on Sunday. It's weighted as such in order to keep it relevant and dramatic as long as possible, and so that you could have a wipeout on day one before zero down, then have two good match wins on Saturday, and that lead is wiped out. Now, and it also means that, let's say, if you just lost everything on the first 2 days, you could still make a comeback on the final day. A lot of people on social media, I ran a poll about this, Catherine. I wanted to know what people thought, and stop trying to interrupt me. I want to give the results to this poll.
You want to know what I think?
No, I want to give the results.
I want to know what you think. I don't want to know.
55% of people liked it. 55% of people liked it out of 1,284.
It's not a question of, like, I mean, it's more nuanced than that, David.
Oh, okay. What do you think?
I think it solves a problem which needs to be solved, but it creates other problems. I mean, it is completely contrived, and it definitely lends itself. It's a point in the column of this is an exhibition, because it is completely contrived, and it does allow you to hide your weakest players. But equally, it beats dead rubbers, doesn't it? You know, look what happened in the recent Davis Cup semi-final with France and Spain. Yeah. You know, those two absolutely meaningless dead rubbers that were played on the final day, and the fact that you ended up calling the tie 3-2 to France when we know it was 3-0. So that is a problem with the Davis Cup as it currently stands. Big problem, and I'm all up for solving that problem, and it does solve that problem. But is it the right? I don't have an alternative to solving that problem. But I also don't feel 100% comfortable with the points accumulation system thing.
I'm the same boat, because I enjoyed Sunday. I enjoyed the fact that it was still live, all of these sort of things. But that's the same way, in some regards, as I enjoy a good film that doesn't end with some really boring crescendo and climax. And, you know, I want to get my money's worth as a viewer. But the best drama of all is when the sport produces a moment without being helped along by a scoring system quite like that, I think.
And there also remains, and look, it's not changed from last year when we discussed it, the issue, rest of world doesn't work. For me, that's...
Not as a concept that I think the rest of the world can really get behind. Because I think when you saw the Jack Sock-John Isner duo for North America up against Roger Federer and Alexander Zverev, the place was just bouncing. Now, it was enthusiastic and excitable throughout, but you saw this clear divide between the two. And, you know, if I were just a standard tennis fan, as a European, I'd have been cheering for the Blues in that situation, because that makes sense to me, the same way as the Ryder Cup does. Europe against America. I get that.
And you could do that if it was a mixed event. Men and women.
Yeah.
You could have it Europe against America. The problem you have is the Labour Cup, and he's Australian.
Yes.
So you can't exclude Australia. So, again, I don't have the absolute solution. I would like to see, I'd love to see it be a mixed event. I think that would enhance it greatly. I think it would solve a number of the issues. Like, you could maybe have it, given that Europe is so dominant, particularly in the men's event, and it's broadly equal in women's tennis. You can maybe have Europe taking on a different territory every year. Have it be America one year, Australasia another year.
Do you know what, though? It does feel like you end up trying to crowbar a solution in.
You are.
And what they've done is probably created the very best product that they can with what they've got.
Yes, but the partisan element is so crucial.
Well, here's where I ultimately have the biggest problem with it, is tennis doesn't need its own answer to Ryder Cup. Tennis needs the right Davis Cup.
Agreed.
And whatever solution is found for Davis Cup, it, to my mind, it needs to incorporate the very best of the Laver Cup. And there are so many good things to it. And it needs to find a way to produce itself in that way, have all the world's eyes on it at the same time. That's why I do like the idea of a year, you know, a single week or a 10-day event. But by making too big a fuss of Laver Cup and also World Team Cup or whatever it is, to me you'd risk diluting the one that has the history, the one that has created moments that these events, I don't think you can just recreate them from scratch, because they've come from the very soul of sport in the Davis Cup. There's a lot wrong with the Davis Cup, but there's something that has to be preserved there, and that is the product, the format that I hope ultimately is the one that we all really get excited about in the future, and the one that works, because that should be tennis's Ryder Cup.
Agreed, I completely agree. And then we come back to the whole sort of debate over exhibition, because I'm not sure anyone would ever call Davis Cup an exhibition, nor should it be. I'm fine with I think the Laver Cup should be more comfortable with being an exhibition. The players can still really care about it, and we can all really care about its existence and get behind it. Perhaps not about the independent results, you know, covering the matches, Simon Briggs flying home before they start. I think that's all okay. I think there's a place for it as a really good exhibition event that people can watch and enjoy, mostly as entertainment, where the quality of tennis is high and thrilling, and it's important that the players care, but which is something different to the Davis Cup, which is not an exhibition, which is the Ryder Cup of tennis.
It's the team Grand Slam, really, isn't it? And at least that's what it should be, and it's been allowed to be dismissed in many ways as part of the conversation because of the format being so unwieldy and sprawling. And that's its challenge, is how do you preserve all the best bits of Davis Cup that everybody loves so much and yet make it a package that everybody's eyes are on at the same time?
Well, I can tell you a way that you don't do that, David, or I don't think you do that, and that is by introducing the Majesty Cup.
Exclusive broken by Simon Briggs of the Telegraph.
Big exclusive for Simon.
Over there. What is the Majesty Cup?
The Majesty Cup apparently is a 64-man winner takes all event with a prize pot of $7.5 million supplied by Cosmos, which is the investment firm that Gerard Piquet is involved in. So this is one of the sort of events by stealth that seemed, well, certainly from the outside, it might not be a case for those involved in the internal workings of that Cosmos deal, but from the outside it seems like these two extra events, there's also talk of a mixed team event in sort of April time or something, isn't there, but have snuck in by stealth with the Davis Cup reform vote to be staged the week after the US Open, so potentially a rival to Laver Cup, filling one of the gaps in the calendar that will appear next year because of the Davis Cup reforms. Have you had anybody that thinks that this is a good idea, David? Anyone at all?
Not really. And the thing is that, again, it just highlights the divisions and the mess that the sport and its various governing bodies and factions are in here. Because in producing a wonderful solution to a standalone, exciting event in the Laver Cup, Federer and team have just added really another ingredient to this enormous potion of problems that we currently have, as wonderful as the event is, because this is not this is not going to work, having this number of events and expecting us to take all of them seriously.
Who would want to, unless you're, you know, one of the world's top five, given the dominance of the big four, you know, and maybe you can include a couple of others in that, who's going to want to enter when it's a 64-man winner-take-all event? You know, if you're 30 in the world, I don't know, if you're Albert Ramos-Vinolas, I don't think he is 30 in the world, but just as I plucked him out of thin air, are you going to want to enter that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're going to do
appearance
fees.
I mean, I'm sure the success of the, with all due respect, success of the event probably doesn't depend on Albert Ramos-Vinolas.
No.
But you know what I mean.
Well, it's just, you're just crying out for a kind of pathway for the sport that makes sense. And it's got four Grand Slam tournaments. Okay, maybe you might move one of them in dates a little bit or something like that. But effectively, you've got four hugely respected and successful events that matter enormously, that are way more important than money could ever be on its own. And that's what people remember about the sport. Same as the Davis Cup to a lesser degree, because frankly, it's been mishandled over the years in terms of what it is. If you just keep throwing additional events in the way, it's making the calendar worse. They've got to get together. And actually, Roger Federer's interview with Simon Briggs had Roger Federer saying, Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal and me, we need some time to talk about this. I want to hear what they've got to say about all these ideas, about the Majesty Cup, which he'd heard about the Davis Cup plans, which Federer was not prepared to commit to at this stage for next year. He's got his own Laver Cup now. They have no intention of moving that out of the way either. But they need to get together for the good of the sport, all of these people, and try and hammer this out, because it's a mess. As simple as that.
Sorry, I thought I just saw Simon Briggs. There's a Simon Briggs lookalike just entering the car. It's not Simon Briggs.
You're out of your chair about to go and collar him.
Do you not agree that man looks like Simon Briggs?
Well, should we go and ask him to come on, see what he's got to say about this?
He might be waiting for the 1450 to Salisbury.
Right, maybe he is.
Last bit of any other business, David. Annabelle Medina Garrigues. The stage an event where everybody on the court were women. Chair umpires, physios, ball kids, everyone. Isn't that great?
Yeah, this is a woman who's done a lot. Aside from having an excellent career in her own right, she reached the last 16 of the Australian and French Open. She was French Open doubles champion twice. You know, she's been around the block as a player and as a coach. And that is just, I've noticed this a few times with her on social media. Occasionally she'll just get involved in a discussion and just put it to bed immediately with a view that makes total sense. And I do love the fact that she's just thought, this is a statement, this is something I want to do with my tournament, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, and there's not enough. We had a brief chat on WhatsApp this week about, I was just lamenting, as much as I sort of understand it with the money and the deals and everything on offer, I was lamenting the fact that there are very few players that really stick their neck on the line for causes in tennis. You know, what made me realise it was Kevin Anderson's support of Nick McCarville's event about the lack of out men in tennis, lack of openly gay men in tennis, the event that he staged prior to the US Open in New York, and how notable it was that Kevin Anderson lent his support to that on Twitter. I mean, everyone should have been supporting that, shouldn't they? I mean, that should be, that's...
And he went out of his way to do it. He wasn't asked to do it. He's not a gay man himself, and yet he felt, this is important to me. I care about this subject. I'm just going to tell people that.
Absolutely, and there's not a lot of that. There's really not a lot of it. People shy away, as much as it shouldn't be controversial to support gay rights in sport. It obviously is seen as such because players do shy away from it, and there's plenty of issues that players shy away from. So, yeah, okay, it's easier once you've retired, which Annabelle Medina Garrigues has, but she's still very much involved in the sport. And, more of that, please, more of that. And on that note, David, you can go and get the 1450 to Woking.
But I don't need to go there.
Which, there's one to Reading there, stopping at Winnersh.
No, you're all right.
And Winnersh Triangle.
You can take that one.
Nice neck of the woods, that.
Right.
none going to Solihull though, because you're down here for the week.
Yeah, I'm here for BT Sport for the week to commentate on Wuhan.
Go on, give your support to Wuhan.
Early morning,
the Linarless event.
Early morning alarm call. Johanna Konta's already out. She lost to Ash Barty today. Not a surprising result, and no, because Barty just causes a nightmare.
She doesn't like those matchups. So she's like a Su Wei Shea. Remember her losing to Su Wei Shea? But that Simon Briggs lookalike is like loitering nearby.
He's heard us talking about him.
We will endeavour to get you a picture of the Simon Briggs lookalike as proof for the podcast to go with the picture of David Law watching some pigeons.
They don't know what Simon Briggs looks like. We need to do one of those halved photos.
All right, okay. I'm going to go and do that before he disappears. David, you're going to go and catch the 1457 to Strawberry Hill.
On my way.
We will be back next week. Oh, not before I tell you that we are the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Prime Video UK, and with our executive producers, Melanie Bowes, SSSTennisBalls.com, with La Manga Club, and with Charlie the Ferret. So we really will be back next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.